Three cases this morning, and we're going to start with the Mondelli case. Yes, one of you will have to get up.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michael Foreman. I'm the director of the Penn State Civil Rights Appellate Clinic, and I'm also the supervising attorney on this case. I wanted to introduce Anna Nocek and Kira Geary, who will be arguing the case, and thank the court for giving them the opportunity to argue the case. And with that, I will get out of their way and let them go forward.
Well, first, thanks to you, Mr. Foreman, for your work, and we'll be happy to listen to your charges, and we are going to be peppering them with questions.
Go ahead.
May I proceed?
Yes, please.
Judge Greenaway, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Anna Nocek, and I serve as court-appointed amicus counsel for Mr. Victor Mondelli, the appellant in the present case.
So let's just ask you one thing to begin with. You're here as amicus, not as pro bono counsel representing Mr. Mondelli, right? Just so that we're clear for the record, yeah?
Correct, Your Honor.
And obviously you're going to help us with your understanding of the work that you've done and your understanding of 17C, et cetera. Yeah?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay,
and
fabulous.
If I could just follow up on one further question. Is your understanding that Mr. Mondelli no longer opposes the amicus participating in these proceedings?
Correct, Your Honor. He has consented to amicus's presentation in this court as well today.
Right, and that's in the record. I think I saw a letter and... I guess an email exchange to that effect. So I think we're all clear on that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Since I have your attention at the moment, how much time would you like for rebuttal?
2 minutes, Your Honor.
Right. And are you all, I know you're splitting subject.
Yes.
You're going to split the 2 minutes? Or?
Well, I'll be arguing for 7 minutes, 17C. My co-counsel will be arguing the polls factors for 6 minutes, and then we will spend 2 minutes on rebuttal.
Very good. Go ahead, please.
Rule 17C applies to Mr. Mondelli's case regardless of the fact that he was represented by counsel. And therefore, the district court abused its discretion in failing to grant a competency hearing or at least inquire into Mr. Mondelli's incompetency upon being provided with verifiable evidence of his incompetence. If that is the rule of law this court chooses to apply, then as my co-counsel will explain, the Polis factors cannot possibly be weighed against Mr. Mondelli.
Well, let me ask you.
Go ahead.
We do this all the time. Thank you. Let me ask you this question about 17C, right? So as it relates to unrepresented litigants, we know that Gardner and Powell are what we're going to look to. Should we equate representatives in the context of 17C with legal counsel?
No, Your Honor. We would actually argue that unrepresented in Rule 17C means an individual who does not have a duly appointed representative. The two sentences of Rule 17C have to be taken in conjunction with one another. Rule 17C2 reads that a minor or an incompetent person who does not have a duly appointed representative may sue by a guardian ad litem or a next friend. The court must appoint a guardian ad litem for an individual who is unrepresented in an action. Those two sentences have to be taken in conjunction with one another. So
responsibility of a duly represented person, as you've described it, and legal counsel.
Well, Your Honor, as the model rules of professional conduct state, a lawyer serves as an agent within a litigation, but they do not serve as a decision maker, whereas a duly appointed representative would serve as a decision maker within the litigation. As the district court noted, Mr. Rosalini was placed in the untenable position of trying to serve as both counsel and guardian. He was not able to become the decision maker within the case. He even asked during the telephone conference, which can be found on pages 13 through 15 of the joint appendix, for a power of attorney for Mr. Mondelli so that they would be able to sign documents, provide with Rules 26 disclosures, and answer interrogatories. Further, as this court noted in footnote 14 in Gardner, it is generally inadvisable for counsel to serve as both guardian and as counsel. Because
what's the concerns that are implicated by that dual, wearing those both hats?
I'm going to interrupt for a second, not because I want to interrupt the judge. We're having trouble hearing you. Do you mind taking your mask off?
No, not at all.
Thank you. Please answer Judge Schwartz's question.
You remember what it is?
Will you repeat the question?
I'm happy to do that. What's the challenges when a lawyer is asked to wear both hats? That is, one, being their legal representative to take positions before a court in a proceeding, as compared to someone who is a decision maker for the individual. What's the challenge? Why is that so hard?
Well, Your Honor, because a decision maker serves the best interest of the client, but they take the client's interest into account and also make the best decision, whereas a lawyer has to serve as counsel serving the best interest of the client, but cannot make those decisions and cannot sign documents for the client. That's what the decision maker or a guardian ad litem would have done in this case.
So one is representing the advocating legal interest but not making a decision, and the other is making decisions and also considering non-legal interests of the person they represent. Is that your position?
Correct, Your Honor.
I want you to focus for a moment on what this discussion or what effect this discussion has on the court. Yep. So we're really talking about what duty arises through Powell, right? So my question is this. Are you suggesting a court always has a duty to inquire when the issue of competency arises?
Well, Your Honor, that was a concern of this court in Powell. This court noted in Powell that bizarre behavior alone is not enough. So it is not always a triggering duty for the district court. It is only a duty that is triggered upon receipt of verifiable evidence. In Powell, verifiable evidence constituted just one letter from a psychiatrist stating that the psychiatrist believed the litigant to be incompetent because they had ADD and major depression. Here, 11 different letters were submitted to the district court stating that Mr. Mondelli had major depression, paranoid schizophrenia. Also, Mr. Mondelli submitted a certified affidavit that he had been found incompetent by a municipal court in New Jersey. Upon receipt of that verifiable evidence, the district court's duty of inquiry was triggered, and they did have to inquire into Mr. Mondelli's incompetence.
Okay, let's take a step back then. So how should we think about verifiable evidence now? I presume your argument would be, look, you know, there's so many letters here, you know, they're all speaking towards the same, you know, malady. But, of course, as we think about it and write, we have to sort of line draw, right? So, and my question isn't, like, is one letter not enough and are three letters enough? Right? That's not the point. But how should we think about verifiable evidence?
Well, Your Honor, verifiable evidence, it would be any evidence submitted to the court at the district court level that goes to show that an individual would be found incompetent in a court proceeding. So in this case, the letters were enough. In Powell, this court also noted that any evidence that someone was found incompetent by another district court would also be verifiable evidence. So in following the reason of Powell, a psychiatrist letter or evidence that someone was found incompetent by another district court would be verifiable evidence. While this court did not specifically define what exactly constitutes verifiable evidence in Powell, this is a chance to clarify that rule. And we would argue that any evidence submitted to the district court tending to show that an individual is incompetent would be verifiable evidence.
And all that does is trigger a duty of inquiry. It does. It's not a finding of competency. It just notifies the court, now you have to find out if the person is competent. Am I right?
Correct, Your Honor. This court did know in citing Ferrelli in Powell that the district court needs to at least consider the idea that Rule 17C may apply to a litigant's case upon receipt of verifiable evidence.
Mr. Rossellini was retained counsel?
Correct, Your
Honor. Original counsel. So how do you sort out or limit the intrusion of the court into the attorney-client relationship? Mr. Rossellini's view was that there was no need for appointed counsel for represented guardian ad litem. So where does that put the court? How far does the court go in inquiring as to that relationship?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Rossellini did acknowledge that he was not able to make all of these decisions for Mr. Mondelli. Additionally, we would argue that at the district court level, I see my time is expiring. May I just briefly answer your question?
Oh, relax. The red light's a suggestion.
Thank you. Well, Your Honor, upon receipt of that verifiable evidence, we would say that the district court needs to put the interests of the litigant in plain view in front of the interests of the lawyer-client relationship, because that client
is
incompetent.
My question is, how far does that go? How intrusive into the relationship of the lawyer to the client does the court need to go? Was it prima facie, or is it Is it a deep dive into that relationship? Is there a concern about that?
Well, Your Honor, while it may be a concern, that is something that can be discussed at a competency hearing, but the district court still has that duty to inquire into an individual's incompetence upon receipt of verifiable evidence. And then at...
I'm listening.
And at that competency hearing, there would be more evidence brought in, and that lawyer-client relationship could be explored further at that competency hearing.
Let me ask you this. So verifiable evidence is presented. The court is alerted. I have to have a hearing. Now a hearing is had. How does Poulos come in? Because it would appear that one way of thinking about this is once 17C is triggered and you have your hearing, Poulos really doesn't play a role. But I know that your colleague is the Poulos person for the day, but what I'm trying to inquire is, does the triggering of a 17C hearing sort of cut off any consideration or necessary consideration of the Poulos factors?
Well, Your Honor, with a finding of incompetency, at least three of the Poulos factors cannot possibly be weighed against a litigant, and it is a balancing determination, and as my co-counsel will mention, at least three of the factors, specifically personal responsibility, a history of dilatoriness, and bad faith, cannot possibly weigh against a litigant who is incompetent at the district court level.
So, okay, let's flip it. Hearing is held, the person's competent.
Well, Your Honor, at that point, the fact that the individual still does have mental illnesses, and in this specific case, severe paranoid schizophrenia and major depression, still does have to be taken into account when weighing the Poulos factors. And an inadequate foundation on even one of the Poulos factors does require is reversible error, as this court has noted.
I agree to concede that if the person is competent, the Poulos factors were likely properly weighed by the district court. Didn't you guys concede that already?
Yes, Your Honor. However, that competency determination does have to be made by the district court. We are simply asking that this court reverse the case so that that competency determination can be made at the district court level.
You know, you're asking the court to impose a rule that says if incompetency is determined, the court's got to go out and appoint, find someone to serve in this capacity, right? And if you have experience, as we have seen in the efforts to try to find pro bono counsel, we're now asking a whole group of other folks to join us. So think, if you could just take that frame for a moment. Should the court jump to the merits of the case first before even going through this exercise, cognizant of the fact that the inquiry that could lead to the need to appoint somebody could be for the purposes of a case that substantively lacks legal merit? Have you thought about that?
Well, Your Honor, no, the court first must determine whether or not the litigant is incompetent so they can have that decision maker. That decision maker would be able to amend a complaint. And while the merits of the case are one of the factors in the Poulos factor, it is a six-factor analysis, and no one factor is dispositive, as this court noted.
I'm not in Poulos land for the purpose of this question. I'm in Rule 17 land, and the considerations a district court judge or a magistrate judge may face in considering these circumstances and the consequences. Should they jump to, let me even look to see if this case has any potential merit? Or is it your view that issues, and consistent with perhaps our decision in, it's Gardner or Powell, I can't remember which one, that a determination on merits is really, you can't, it's got to survive 1915, which is basically the frivolity, it's not frivolous. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, Your Honor.
And beyond that, though, the court should stay its hand.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the merits of the case do have to be weighed in that could be done at that competency hearing as well. However, that competency hearing does have to be had before we can just dismiss a case on the merits without inquiring into whether or not an individual is actually incompetent and can't proceed with their prosecution of their case.
Are you asking us to impose a rule, as a slightly different subject, that says counsel can never serve as a Rule 17 representative?
No, Your Honor, that is up to the discretion of the district court. However, that would be a determination made at a competency hearing, which, as this court noted in Powell, is triggered upon receipt of verifiable evidence. The district court must have a competency hearing or at least inquire into an individual's incompetence.
Thank you.
And what is the initial showing that needs to be made in order to trigger the competency hearing?
Well, Your Honor, it would be receipt of verifiable evidence. As this court noted in Powell, verifiable evidence could be evidence from another court that the litigant was found incompetent, or it can be a letter from a psychiatrist stating that the psychiatrist believed the litigant to be incompetent. In this case, there were 11 different letters submitted to the district court. Specifically, there was a letter submitted on page 98 of the joint appendix acknowledging that Mr. Mondelli had a severe psychiatric illness. The Ninth Circuit in Allen v. Calderon suggested that the holding in Powell suggests that any evidence submitted to the district court which tends to show that an individual has a severe mental illness would be verifiable evidence of incompetence, and that duty would be triggered.
The district court acted correctly, though, when it opined that there was nothing in front of it concerning the alleged declaration of incompetency by the Fanwood Municipal Court. Her Honor was correct then, right?
Yes, Your Honor. There was not evidence. However, there was that sworn affidavit by Mr. Mondelli that he had been found incompetent of by the municipal court in New Jersey. And as well, there was those 11 different letters submitted from psychiatrists.
But there was a difference between the evidence presented to the magistrate judge and the evidence presented to the district judge. Is your argument that the evidence before the magistrate judge was either constructively or part of the record that the district judge should have looked at, or are we talking about simply the evidence that was presented to the district judge?
Well, Your Honor, the evidence that was presented to the district, to the magistrate, was also presented to Judge Salas, and Judge Salas at the district court level did acknowledge that she had reviewed the record, that she did go through the certification and the supporting documentation in the telephone conference, which is found on pages 1 through 15 of the joint appendix. So at that point, her duty of inquiry was triggered because she did review the record and specifically the certification and supporting documentation.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Good morning.
After you introduce yourself, I have a question.
Sure. Would you like me to take off the mask?
Absolutely.
As I did? Okay. Right, Your Honors, and may it please the court. As my co-counsel mentioned, my name is Kira Geary. I will be speaking to the second issue presented in this case.
So what I'm interested in, I won't presume that my colleagues are, but what I'm interested in is the interplay between Poulos on the one hand and 17C on the other. So specifically, when does a 17C inquiry essentially cut off a necessity to address the Poulos factors? Yeah? Okay. So first, once it's triggered, we've gone through verifiable evidence and, you know, okay, we're going to have the hearing. Is the way to think about Poulos in that context, if incompetency is ultimately found pursuant to a 17C hearing, you don't get to Poulos because now the court has to go through a process of finding a representative, and that's one path. On the other hand, if the 17C hearing is held and the court then makes a finding of competency, it's not necessarily so that you go to Poulos because you might proceed on a non-Poulos path, but one potential way would be once competency is found to then go on the Poulos path. Am I thinking about this the right way?
Yes. So the rule of law that we would submit is that in an instance such as this, where the plaintiff does have that verifiable evidence of incompetence submitted to the district court, that the district court needs to resolve that issue first before moving on to the Poulos factors, because the Poulos factors, it's a six-factor test. It's a holistic review. No one factor is dispositive. And in this situation, the district court disregarded entirely most of the evidence that was submitted. Those psychiatric letters were not mentioned. And so in that situation, it the decision to dismiss based on those factors inherently rely on the district court having to hold the plaintiff in that case personally responsible for their actions. So
let me ask you this question. Maybe I should have asked this of your colleague. If so, we'll do it on rebuttal. The letters are sparse, right? I think we could all agree, you know, one or two sentence letters explaining that someone's schizophrenic is sparse. Why shouldn't we look at this record and say the district judge actually did what she was supposed to, right? She looked at the letters. She chose not to determine that they rose to the level of verifiable evidence of incompetency and then went to the Poulos factors.
So the particular hearing where Judge Salas was reviewing those records was not a competency hearing. So at that point, you know, a determination of Mr. Mondelli's competency wasn't happening. And when that telephone conference happened, the letters were in front of the district court, but there was no notice to Mr. Mondelli to provide more before then because there was no suggestion that his incompetence was at issue in that particular situation.
Because his lawyer represented to the judge, the district court judge, that he needed a power of attorney because he couldn't get his client to focus. He couldn't make a decision on his behalf, meaning counsel couldn't. So it sounds to me like Mondelli's lawyer was making a representation that competency was at issue. So
yes, and at that point, that would have also been the point where, as part of Rule 17C, that duty of inquiry at the district court level should have been triggered.
I think what Judge Greenaway was asking, he can obviously correct me, is the materials in front of the district judge, assuming she actually read them,
yes,
and saw them, was on notice of them, as Judge Greenaway characterized them, and I think appropriately, are sparse. Isn't it, could we infer from her conclusion that it was insufficient to trigger the duty?
I do not believe that the letters, while they are sparse, there were 11 different letters, and some of those letters specifically said that his paranoid schizophrenia, his major depression, prevented him from going into court. They prevented him from understanding his legal issues. So while those letters were sparse, they were brief, they did say enough that directly connected Mr. Mondelli's mental state to his ability to prosecute his own claims. So in that situation, we would submit that the duty of inquiry would have been triggered and that determination of competency should have been made before the district court examined the first, third, and fourth Poulos factor, which all rely on having to hold the plaintiff in this situation accountable for his own actions.
You're asking us to excuse the dilatory. I understand the position concerning personal responsibility,
yes,
and bad faith or willfulness factors as potentially being excused based upon one's,
yes,
mental health. But you're also asking us to conclude that the dilatoriness factors could also be excused. Why?
So the dilatoriness factors, as to that, the appellees claimed that the statute of limitations initially had run out on the claim by one day, that when it ran out, that was on a Sunday. So we would argue that that wasn't even necessarily the case. But even if there was any delay, equitable tolling is certainly available in situations like these. This court has said that that's available so long as there's reasonable diligence and extraordinary circumstances present. So Mr. Mondelli's incompetence in this situation certainly would.
I think that the dilatoriness factor there is his delay in connection with moving the case forward. In this case, was cooperating with discovery, not the statute of limitations question.
And that's true. But I think in this situation especially, his incompetence also weighs into the fact that discovery wasn't able to happen because Mr. Rosalini wasn't able to get a hold of Mr. Mondelli, wasn't able to get his consent to participate in discovery. And so his incompetence then would also weigh into that consideration because, again, much of this was due to his incompetence and not necessarily due to any purposefully evasive actions, any kind of delay that was his personal responsibility in that situation.
I asked your adversary, your colleague, forgive me, your colleague, this question. Why not just jump to meritoriousness? Like, why should the district court go through all of these steps? And why shouldn't a district court judge have the discretion to, like, look at the merits of the case and make a conclusion as to whether this case could ever survive the 12B6 or something along those lines?
Your Honor, at the district court level during that telephone conference, Judge Salas explicitly declined to dismiss Mr. Mondelli's intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. So at that point, that claim would still have been alive if not for the other factors that were weighed.
Did the district court judge have jurisdiction, or would she have only had supplemental jurisdiction over that claim because she had opined that the ADA claim was not legally cognizable? Perhaps her rationale wasn't quite on point, but she already had concluded that. So what was the jurisdiction for the court to even hold the emotional distress claim?
Meaning
subject matter jurisdiction. Was it supplemental jurisdiction? Because I don't know if there was complete diversity between these parties.
No, from my understanding, the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim would have been supplemental jurisdiction added on because of that ADA claim, so they could all have been heard at
Why
once.
Was it timely? What is the event that led to the emotional infliction of emotional distress that was still timely in March of 2016? What was the triggering event?
So I believe that the triggering event was the nursing home denying Mr. Mondelli the access to his mother. And that was...
No longer having 12 hours, having 1 to 2 hours in the lobby?
Yes. That would be the triggering event in that situation.
Thank you.
You may have touched on this, and if so, just remind me. But in the instance where 17C is considered and you end up with a competency ruling from the court, as if you were, assume for a moment, just for a moment, that you were counsel for Mr. Mondelli, would you argue during the court's consideration of the Poulos factors that, notwithstanding the competency determination, that the medical condition should be considered within the six factor?
I believe discussion. that would be an appropriate argument to make, because the rule asks for the court to determine the extent of the party's personal responsibility. And I think even without that formal determination of incompetency, that those types of issues, mental illness issues, could still be considered in a more holistic way of evaluating how personally responsible the plaintiff would have been for the delays in this case.
Well, what is the, is there any balancing in this case to the extent that the defendant is being dragged through these series of events and has an interest in the orderly resolution of this case?
Yes.
How is that interest play in trying to determine that, whether there is competency or not competency?
So I believe that would go to the second factor in the Poulos test that evaluates the prejudice to the adversary here. Here, the appellees do claim that they would be prejudiced by this. However, our position is that the prejudice here itself is minimal and by itself would not warrant dismissal. The appellees were on notice of these claims since 2016, so that was the same year that the nursing home was sold. Even without Mr. Mondelli's participation, those documents that were important could have been placed on a litigation hold. They could have reached out to the involved parties. And additionally, much of the delay that happened here that would make it more difficult to litigate the case for both parties, not just the defendant, were largely due to the fact that when the verifiable evidence of Mr. Mondelli's incompetence was presented to the court, that competency hearing was not triggered. And as a result, the litigation dragged out for much longer than it needed to, because Mr. Mondelli did not have a guardian ad litem to represent his interests, to sign documents, to have discovery proceed.
So you would have... there would be a determination beyond the first factor, regardless of whether or not there was a finding of incompetency. You would continue to run, not just stop at personal responsibility, but all of the other factors would have to be weighted in as well.
Yes, it's a six-factor test. No one factor is dispositive. However, this court did state in 2019 in Hildebrand versus Allegheny County that it has never upheld a court's dismissal when it was supported by an inadequate foundation on even one of the Polis factors. So here, the district court's disregard of Mr. Mondelli's mental illness, the verifiable evidence of incompetency that was submitted, is enough for reversal in this situation, despite the fact that there are three other factors that the district court also weighed.
Was Hildebrand cited in your brief?
It is not. No, it is not.
Session, please.
Hildebrand, I'm not exactly sure of the exact citation. That was in 2019, and it was quoting Neves versus Thorne, which was an unpublished or non-precedential opinion.
But you can't represent us whether or not Hildebrand itself was a precedential opinion.
It is a precedential opinion. Hildebrand was a precedential opinion. It was quoting a non-precedential opinion that was decided the same year. And I can get that citation for you on rebuttal.
I'll find it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Are you ready? Two against one.
I'm on the defense side. It happens all the time. May it please the court. I have to excuse me for a second because I'm getting immense feedback from my... I apologize. I'm hard of hearing, so with all these shields, it's... system that they have here is actually pretty
good. There's someone I work with that I would love to have use the device that you're talking about, but
just turn
that person just doesn't want to get there, so...
I think, Your Honors, may it please the court, Walter Koala from Marshall Ben, he, Warner, Coleman, and Goggin, on behalf of the defendants. I think we need to look at the actual text of 17C. It specifies that the duty that we're talking about here applies when a party is unrepresented. It's obviously uncontested here that Mr. Rossellini...
What is it about the language of 17C that you want to point us to, or the case law that you're going to rely on, that unrepresented must mean pro se?
Well, I would say the language of 17C itself, where it says who is unrepresented in an action, that's the start. The Powell case, the Ferrelli case from the Second Circuit, which it adopted. And frankly, it seemed to me that every case from this court that's addressed Powell in the context of not just citing it for run-of-the-mill legal proposition in terms of a standard of care, something like that. There's like one or two of them. Anyone that dealt with it substantively was dealing with pro se parties.
How about Gardner?
Gardner's the one exception, and as I make note in my brief, it's the exception that proves the rule. There in a case you had a clear, distinct potential conflict so that the attorney could be held as essentially not representing the daughter, I believe it was, for that particular issue. But every other case that's looking at this issue is talking about pro se parties.
There are two leaps, as I see it, that we need to make in order to come to the conclusion that you'd like for us to make. Number one, that a lawyer... should be deemed in any 17C situation to be able to fill into the roles outlined in C1. Number two, that a lawyer is qualified to step into those roles. And number three, that it's the intent of the drafters, I guess. Ultimately, it may be a rubber stamp, but ultimately Congress is responsible for the rules that Congress intended for this to be representative, to be synonymous with lawyer. And when it comes to the question of competence and the kind of representation that's required to fill these roles under C1, I don't see how we can deem representative and counsel synonymously. I know that was a lot to unpack, but we've got time.
Right. Here, my response to that would be this, is that the rule, nor my argument,
is saying that an attorney necessarily can act as a guardian ad litem. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that the trigger for the language that the court must appoint, okay, that's the only thing that the representation affects, and here's why. Because in addition to this rule, there are also the rules of professional conduct, and the attorney representing the party with a diminished capacity has the obligation to make that analysis and to request a guardian ad litem when it's appropriate. And that was not done here. Mr. Rossellini was...
for a power of attorney. Now, maybe he didn't use the language as contemplated under Rule 17C, but his words surrounding it was, I can't make decisions for my client.
Correct.
And please appoint someone to do that, like a power of attorney. So wasn't the court on notice that he, counsel, had made his own judgment that he needed someone to speak on Mr. Mondelli's behalf?
I don't believe so, because I think number one, there's a distinct difference between a power of attorney and a guardian ad litem. And the key in my mind is the fact that Mr. Rossellini didn't need leave of court to get a power of attorney to involve someone else in the case. Now, he had the ability to petition the court to appoint a guardian ad litem, but if Mr. Mondelli came to him and said, my diminished capacity is such that I'm incapacitated, Mr. Rossellini could have said, okay, well, let's get a power of attorney. You appoint an agent to represent you in the litigation. And they could have done that alone by themselves. The fact that they didn't, and all he was asked point blank, Mr. Rossellini, what do you want me to do? What do you want? And he didn't say appoint someone. He said, give me more time. And this is after, of course, you know, many, many months of extensions.
I think what Judge Schwartz is trying to get to and what I'm terribly interested in is, what is the obligation of the court and what is the obligation of the attorney? I mean, I think her point was, okay, admittedly, the correct nomenclature was not used, right? But substantively, listening to what he asked of her, I can't do both. I can't represent him. There's an impediment to me being who I have to be, which is his attorney. Essentially, I need help. I've put before you, Judge, information that speaks to 17C, although he did not call out 17C in the way that, we might in hindsight say that he should. So the question is, under what circumstances is there a trigger? And I hear you on the nomenclature. That's a given. But on the substance, that seems to be, she'll correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what we're excited to hear from you about. Because substantively, it seems we're already at 17C and we've got to kind of figure it out. And in thinking about writing something at the end of this, one of the things is going to be, when is this triggered? And it would seem that the facts here trigger.
Well, I would say that under 17C, the fact that the plaintiff was a represented party limits what the district court could do in that case. And I think the district court here gave plaintiff's attorney every opportunity to petition for a guardian if the attorney thought that was appropriate and didn't do that. And I think at that point, the protection of the attorney-client privilege, which Your Honor was talking about earlier, I think that comes into play.
But the duty of the court to protect the incompetent goes beyond 17C. That is, if the court determines that the incompetent needs representation, it would have the power to do so, wouldn't it?
Well, I think that the issues, again, depend on the particulars of that person. In the majority of cases where you have pro se plaintiffs.
That's right. It's a sort of unusual case because the incompetent has a lawyer. But I'm trying to fix that the scope of that duty goes beyond 17C, whether the party is represented or unrepresented. If it's a determination that the incompetent needs protection, the court can appoint and should appoint then a guardian ad litem.
Well, but I think that in this case, what you also have to look at is the nature of the materials that was placed before the district court.
I'm sorry, the nature of the what?
Of the materials that were put before the court. I mean, there are a number of letters, and some of them are talking about, you know, he can't be get his air conditioning removed because he has asthma, and there were some others that were talking about.
Be nice. Most of them were substantive.
Oh, well, they were.
Not schizophrenia.
But not all of them, and I'm just simply pointing that out for the record. But even those that dealt with his diminished capacity, that dealt with his mental illness, what we have to look at, did they demonstrate that he didn't have the ability to govern himself and manage his own affairs? And when we're talking specifically about, at its heart, we're talking about Rule 26 disclosures. And, you know, the amicus, you know, was talking about, you know, the ability of my client to, you know, put the people at issue on notice that, you know, they may have to be deposed and whatnot. But without the Rule 26 disclosure, we don't even know who he believes is involved in the case. Mm-hmm. So we have very limited, we have guesswork at that point. And I know that goes to the
But wasn't that enough to inquire? Isn't that the point? Not that the eventual determination would be to appoint someone, but the question would be, shouldn't have had a hearing and make that determination, you know, upon the proofs shown at the hearing?
If he was, my position would be, if he was not represented, absolutely, if it's pro se party. But once you have the attorney in there, then that changes the dynamic.
How?
Because if you have a situation where...
She said...
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
How does that change the dynamic?
Well,
because Rule 17C talks about representative and defines what a representative for the purposes of that rule. So I don't understand why the presence of counsel matters.
Because then the inquiry by the court would start to potentially interfere with that attorney-client relationship. If the attorney and the client... Let's just assume for the sake of argument, they talked, and he said, you know what, I hate these defendants. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to let this keep going and going and going. And if they, you know, we'll submit these letters, and then we'll try to make this as horrible for them as possible. He's not incompetent, and he would, you know, be on that. And I'm not saying this actually happened. Obviously, you know, that this is simply hypothetical. But in that case, when you have a situation where the attorney and the client have agreed to a circumstance or a strategy, say, for example, that potentially could say, you know, a district court may say, you know, this may be an incompetency issue. Well, then you have to inquire again as to what's going on in the relationship with the attorney and the client. Is the judge supposed to bring them in and say, okay, well, are you doing this as a strategy, or is this a part of, you know, your mental illness? What have
That's
you discussed
part of the
with
court's
your attorney?
Ability as a fact finder to make those determinations, and judges have capacities to inquire into the privileged materials without breaching privilege through ex parte inquiry if the judge has some indicia that this is being done for bad purposes, namely to delay or to be hostile towards the other side outside the proper litigation.
Right, and I think the balance here, again, would lie in the question of whether it's a pro se party or representative party. Because in the first instance, the question of whether or not a guardian ad litem is necessary in a represented situation would be with the attorney. He has to make
I don't understand that argument, right? Because when I look at the the language of 17C, it says 17C1, with a representative. The following representatives may sue or defend on behalf of a minor or an incompetent person, right? None of those listed are an attorney. And then without a representative, minor or incompetent person who does not have a duly appointed representative, so who does not have somebody enunciated in 17C1, may sue by a friend or guardian ad litem. So you know, when we think of represented, unrepresented, I just don't get the attorney issue comes first.
Well, I think that the if you look at the other part of that language, the court can issue another appropriate order. And cases dealing with this have found appointment of counsel is another appropriate order. Mm-hmm. And so in those cases, what it's doing is folding in the representation into that question. And so in this case, when you have the represented party already, okay, then I think it, like I said, I think it just changes the whole dynamic. And in the first instance, the issue of do we need guardian ad litem has to come from the plaintiff's attorney.
Well, it did here.
It did here.
He made a request for some independent person to be the decision maker for the client. But I want to pause on that because I know you don't think that was sufficient. I understand that's your position. Am I correct? That's your position?
And I think that the plain fact that Judge Shaw said, what do you want me to do? Open-ended question. And he said, more time.
Where in the record does in the hearing? Because I want to ask you another question about what happened at that hearing, where he said, where she asked, what do you want me to do?
And we all have it, so you can feel free to give us the line and page.
Okay, it is on Joint Appendix 15, starting on line 14. Mr. Rossellini, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? I can't leave this open indefinitely. I can't. And he responded, well, I would ask for one more extension.
Okay, and then she continues, and this gets to my next question. I understand. Thank you for drawing that to my attention.
Sure.
Judge Salas represents, if your client is not mentally fit, I mean, again, I have no proof. This is lines 23 and 24 at Joint Appendix 15. Does that indicate to you that Her Honor was unaware of the letters we've been talking about? Because the thrust of the communication about the proof, quote unquote, of his competency seemed to focus on the absence of independent evidence about the Fanwood alleged incompetency declaration.
Right.
Her Honor makes no comments about any of these other letters.
No, because they were submitted to the magistrate, not to her.
So she was given on the United States District Court docket. Is your position that because it was only presented to the magistrate judge, meaning directed to him, it did not become part of the district court record?
No, I'm not saying that it wasn't part of the district court record. I'm saying it wasn't in front of her when she was making that determination, and it was plaintiff's attorney's responsibility to present that if that was his position.
The counsel made a representation concerning the May certification to Her Honor, suggesting that he had, that there was this May certification with these attachments.
Right.
Is there some indication that maybe Her Honor overlooked something that counsel brought to Her Honor's attention?
Well, I think that her response indicates that the only thing that was given was the Morristown Medical Center discharge instructions.
But we know that that's not accurate, right?
Well, that was what was given to her.
But Joint Appendix 17, lines 6 through 10, Your Honor, the certification that was filed on May 19th includes documentation of his medical history, including some recent letters of treatment from Robert Wood Johnson Medical School and some others of his treatment. This is not without documentation. Is the district court mistaken by not acknowledging that material having been presented?
Well, I think that the May 19th, that was the magistrate.
I understand that.
Right.
But Her Honor, but you're suggesting it wasn't before her, but Mr. Mondelli's counsel brought it to Her Honor's attention. Are you saying that's not adequate?
I don't think so. In this, with all of everything that happened here, and the fact again that you know he took no steps to ask for a guardian ad litem, and was asked what she could do, he specifically said all he wanted was additional time.
Well, that's because she had suggested moments earlier that he could withdraw. And he said, no, this is my client of long standing. I don't want to withdraw.
And if the client is giving him that kind of problems and not cooperating, that's one option that he does have. And I think that's all she was bringing up, that there are ways to handle a client who refuses to cooperate. But when we get down to, again, Rule 17C, you know, if the party being represented means nothing for 17C, then the last line is should just be read right out of
there. Different scenario. Let's assume that we had a lawyer and client, and during the course of the representation, the client suffers a health condition that renders the client mentally incompetent or physically incapacitated such that they couldn't participate and therefore couldn't make any decisions. Counsel's in the case.
Mm-hmm.
Counsel goes to the trial judge and says, something has occurred. My client is no longer fit to make decisions, either because of a recent mental or a physical incapacitation. I need some help. We need a power of attorney. We need somebody. Is it your position that that fact pattern would not be sufficient to trigger appointment under 17?
I think that's different than what we had here.
Why is it different? Because the only difference in my hypothetical is a newly discovered problem as opposed to historical from 1967 problem.
Because in that case, the attorney is going to the court and saying, I need you to appoint someone. Here, he's saying, I need more time. And had he come into court that day and said, Your Honor, rather than, you know, first thing I want you to do is reinstate my client's complaint from the administrative dismissal, and I want the appointment of a guardian ad litem.
But at JA 13, lines 14 through 18, counsel for Mr. Mondelli says, well, it says he needs a power of attorney. He needs a power of attorney to proceed in this case just because right now in particular there was the municipal proceeding that was transferred to Fanwood finding him incompetent. So the judge was presented with the fact that you say makes my hypothetical different than what happened here.
No, because I think in this case, you know, he's saying that they need a power of attorney. He's not asking for a guardian ad litem, and I think that makes a difference.
Suppose let's tweak the hypothetical. In the Fanwood hearing, there was the foremost expert in schizophrenia, and at that hearing, the Dr. Smith, she said, he's suffering in a way that he's, my medical opinion, incompetent. The municipal court says, great. That's presented to the judge, albeit municipal court finding. Judge, I have the letters, which we have here, and the suggestion by defense counsel on page 17 and 18 are, Judge, I've read them. There are a lot of letters. Some of them say asthma, but some of them speak to his mental state. And I'm sure you've read them, Judge. So the notion that this was on the magistrate judge's docket, but the district court didn't read it, we all know Judge Salas. I've got to credit that she's read it. But back to my hypothetical. That's the only thing you know about the municipal court. That wouldn't be enough to trigger a 17C inquiry?
The problem with the municipal court here is all you had was just a certification by plaintiff that happened. I mean, he doesn't present any record from the court. He didn't present a finding, an order, or anything like that.
It's the municipal court, whatever the representation is, with these letters. That's not enough for verifiable evidence.
Just the statement by the plaintiff himself. That's literally all he presented. He didn't present, you know, something from the court. He presented his own statement saying, I was in court and, you know, I was found to be not competent to stand. We don't have that here. We don't have anything sufficient to trigger it based on that. I mean, if you had a previous competency hearing and, you know, there seemed to be some dispute, Judge Shaw seemed to be of the opinion that magistrate judge, or municipal judge rather, it was an improper venue for that sort of determination to be made. But we'll put that aside. I think you need something more than just simply the plaintiff's assertion that this occurred. I think you need an actual court record. I mean, essentially, what you're asking for is for essentially judicial notice of this occurrence. And if you had an actual court record, it would be different than the plaintiff saying that this thing occurred.
If you put the municipal court aside and assume that all of the letters that were asserted in, I think it's Exhibit B, I'm not sure, were before the court, is that enough?
I don't think so, because right In that situation, what we're looking at is the question of whether, not whether he's mentally ill, not whether he has a diminished capacity, not whether he has a condition, but whether or not he is incapable of essentially doing a Rule 26 disclosure.
That's not the question. The question is whether that presented to the court is sufficient to trigger a 17C inquiry. That's the question. And that I would like an answer to.
And I would say no based on what we're looking at here, based on everything that occurred.
It's a hypothetical. Just give you a hypothetical. You've said that the letters weren't necessarily in front of her. My hypothetical to you is assume the letters
put the letters in front of her.
You know what the letters say now, right?
I do. Sure.
Yeah. Does that trigger the inquiry?
I don't believe so. No. I think that they were minimal at best. And the fact that they were from some cases 50 years ago, I don't think it has any relevance whatsoever, except for if any, minimal. Because the question here isn't, does he suffer from a mental illness? The question isn't, does he have diminished capacity? The question here is he able to manage his own affairs?
The question is whether there was a duty to inquire. And I think that's I think, where we are parting company. I think that you are asking the district judge to make a determination of competency, and I think the issue was whether she should have made an inquiry, that is, whether there were warning signs or signals was something going on here,
right.
And then she should have made an inquiry and maybe ultimately determined that there was no issue. But
well,
I think that's a gap here.
I think that the trigger has to be something more than the statements that were made here, because none of them addressed where we actually were in the case.
So you're thinking that in the exercise of discretion, the district judge did so, and maybe we may disagree with that, but that was a discretionary decision.
Yeah, and fundamentally, I think that, you know, the fact that there was an attorney involved in the case is really, you know, the key factor.
Great. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
All right, how are we carving up these 2 minutes?
Your Honor, I will be doing that.
Okay, very good.
Your Honors, a few quick points on rebuttal. First, we want to acknowledge that Mr. Rosalini is in the courtroom today and was involved in the district court level, which brings me directly to my first point, that the appellee's argument completely gets rid of the language duly appointed representative within Rule 17C. Unrepresented, as we mentioned on during our initial argument, does mean an individual who does not have a duly appointed representative. And at the district court level, Mr. Mondelli did not have that duly appointed representative. Further, the appellees argued that this was not verifiable evidence, that these 11 letters from Mr. Mondelli's doctors did not constitute verifiable evidence. We would point this court to Powell, where the Hartman plaintiff in Powell submitted just a 3-sentence letter, which acknowledged that he had ADD, major depression, and that the doctor believed him to be incompetent. And that did constitute verifiable evidence that triggered a duty of inquiry.
You think that the district court judge reviewed the letters? Is there anything in the hearing transcript that would suggest to you that the district court judge actually saw those letters? Because the references that I saw was the absence of evidence on the Fanwood and a discharge record from Robert Wood. That was it. So do you have anything that would tell you the district court actually considered those letters?
Your Honor, we would point to page 10 of the joint appendix, where Judge Salas does acknowledge that she reviewed the May 19th, 2017 certification, which did have the supporting documentation of those letters. And she does acknowledge that even within that certification, Mr. Mondelli did submit that he had mental illness, that he did have psychiatric issues. And those certifications, those letters were submitted with that May 19th, 2017 certification.
Following up what Judge Rivera was asking your adversary about abuse of discretion, if Her Honor considered those letters and she made the determination sub silentio that that wasn't enough, why should we disturb that?
Well, Your Honor, because there is nothing even within, and I see that my time is up.
At least as far as, it's up to the presider. Can she answer that question, Your Honor?
I would love her to
answer that question. Outstanding. Go right ahead.
Your Honor, we would point this court to Powell, where this court noted that the failure to at least consider that Rule 17C may apply is an abuse of discretion. So while she may have found him incompetent, she did not consider that Rule 17C may apply.
What do you mean she didn't consider it? She may decline to follow it, but what's the basis to say that she did not consider it?
Well, Your Honor, nowhere in that telephone transcript from that...
Incite to it or make reference to it?
Correct, Your Honor. And as this court noted in Powell, the failure to consider that Rule 17C may apply is an abuse of discretion. And further, the appellees argue that Mr. Rosalini should have asked for a guardian for Mr. Mondelli. However, Rule 1.14 of the Model Rules of Professional Conduct is a suggestion, but the district court does have a duty of inquiry into an individual's incompetence. And upon receipt of that verifiable evidence, their duty was triggered, and therefore they abused their discretion in failing to inquire into Mr. Mondelli's incompetency.
I just have one question, because I didn't understand your May 19th reference. The Fanwood reference, the judge says there was no documentary support. Were you saying that the Fanwood papers had the letters appended to them?
Your Honor, that the certification did have that supporting documentation, which was those letters, is my understanding.
Right, but I think to Judge Schwartz's point, the statement at lines 22 and 23 would lead the reader to believe that she wasn't aware that there were letters, right? Because she says the plaintiff also claimed the municipal judge found him incompetent to stand trial, but provided no documentary support for these assertions.
Yes, Your Honor, there was no documentary support that the municipal judge found him incompetent. There was documentary support of his mental illnesses. However, there was not that documentation from the municipal court of Fanwood. But there was documentation that he did have paranoid schizophrenia and major depression.
But she suggests later in the transcript that she had no evidence of any of that. And that's why I asked you what in the record leads you to conclude Her Honor actually reviewed those letters.
And, Your Honor, we would point to the Joint Appendix, page 10, where she does say that she reviewed the certification, which did have that supporting documentation. She did review the record, as she noted in that telephone conference. And despite that, Mr. Mondelli did submit also in that certification that he did have mental illnesses, which Judge Salas did note in the Joint Appendix on page 10, which did trigger that duty of inquiry.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's see now. Once again, Mr. Foreman, we thank you for your service to the court and the wonderful work of the clinic. So we appreciate that very much. Counsel, both sides did an outstanding job today. We appreciate it, and we'll take the matter.